down here in San Diego, 22nd and Market, there was a Presbyterian United Presbyterian Church there. And they wanted to sell because in the late 50s, the suburbs was just booming.
Where was the church?
Here in San Diego, 22nd Market, down there now. Past there, you see it. So they wanted to purchase the church and let me come here to be pastor because there was no black preacher here in San Diego. But they had no money. And Irene, for those 3 years while I was in seminary, had worked for the women's department of the Presbyterian Church. And they said, listen, we haven't given George and Irene anything lately. We'll give them money to purchase their church so they can go to San Diego. That's how I got here.
Okay.
And a lot of bigots in the community opposed my coming.
So Pittsburgh Presbyteria gave you and Mrs. Smith?
No, it was the president, women of the President's Church.
Oh, okay.
National Women
group
that Irene worked for in the literature department. They gave the money to buy the church. So I tell them, that church was given to me. I just let you meet here. So then with our new car, we set out coming to San Diego to start this church, which was at the 22nd and Market. And all that racist stuff didn't bother me. I've been exposed all my life to that type of stuff, all the way back to Montgomery. So I came here, and the National Church sent out four college students with me that summer to start a vacation church school and get the church on the way. Two white young ladies, a white young fella, and a black young fella. That was started us on our way. So I began to work and develop the church there, which we gave the name Golden Hill United Presbyterian Church.
Okay.
And I said to them on December 23rd, 1956, when we were organized, I didn't come way out here to San Diego to be pastor of no welfare church.
Okay.
I give you 5 years, and you better be self-supporting, because if I'm going to go to the Presbyterian meetings of all the other Presbyterian church, how in the world can I stand up and express myself when them white folks are paying my salary?
Okay.
My pride won't let me do that. 5 years, we were self-supporting. And I came here at a time.
How did you grow your congregation?
Well, first of all, through word of mouth and so forth, and through advertisement. Herb Klein, who was president of the Corporate Press, was a member of the La Jolla Presbyterian Church, and from day one, I had the support of that paper. And so a good marketing system.
Right.
And some of your black folk will come down, and after they have service, they go by, who are the Negroes down there trying to act white? That never bothered me. So this city was just dying for black leadership involvement. And as you notice in my book, at one time that I was on the board of about 15 or 17 different agencies because they wanted a black representative or black representative, but the black middle class folks were far and in between when I came here. You could have a meeting of all of them in a telephone booth.
Oh, wow.
And have those days left. But as I served on these things, more and more.
So you were basically on boards with all white?
Oh, goodness. That's all.
Yeah.
Well, nobody else, no Mexican, no black.
Wow.
So I had a whole, I had a whole banner to hold up. But as more and more middle class black folk came to town, I began to have folks I could recommend for some of these
mm-hmm.
boys.
Right.
And that is what I would do. And then I got involved with the education system in 1963.
How did you get involved with the education system?
At that time, San Diego School District had less than two dozen black teachers, less than two dozen Hispanic teachers, and yet they were educating 99% of our kids.
Hmm.
And the group of us who joined with the League of Women Voters, who got the city council to change the system of elected school board members, because it was unfair. Up until that time, your school board members were elected from La Jolla, Point Loma, and Mission Hill. Mm. Nothing from south of 8.
Right.
So they put it on, and it passed. That's when we got District A through E. And our district is District E, and this coalition of folk asked me if I would run for it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons, blacks at that time were far more together than they are now. Right now, their pronouns are me, myself, and I. If you don't get out of my way, I'm going to stab you in the back. But they talked me into running, and I told them, number one, I would run under two or three conditions. I would not run as a black candidate because there are not enough blacks in this city to elect a dog catcher.
Mm-hmm.
I will run as a representative, representing all of the youngsters in this district, all the way from southeast to La Jolla, Tarzana, and all the rest. I would not go in debt running for no seat.
Mm-hmm.
Third, my campaign committee will be completely an integrated one.
Mm-hmm.
So I corral folks from every segment of this community. It looked like the United Nations, and
mm-hmm.
we put on this, we knew it was going to be a struggle. There must have been about five or six.
And this was 1963.
63, okay. Five or six who ran. I was the only black that was running. So I ended up coming out in the primary, and then you had to go citywide.
Mm-hmm. So you're leading in the primary?
Yeah.
You won the primary?
Yeah, and my opponent in the general election was a 72-year-old blind white guy, head of the blind agency in San Diego.
Hmm.
And we had to do some fantastic planning to in this campaign, not let my pictures go on the television, on my literature, sending outstanding San Diego whites on television to testify on my behalf.
Okay.
San Diego Booba. And all of that strategy, I only beat that rascal by 411 votes.
Wow.
That shows you how racist San Diego was.
You beat him by 411 votes.
11 votes. When I got down to the Board of Education, one of the members that were there while we were debating nominating board members of my district, he had opposed it. Dr. Frank Lowell, who's now dead.
Lowell?
L-O-W-E.
Okay.
He's now dead, but he was on the board when I got sworn in. The first thing, I had already developed my agenda as to what I'm going to go after. I want more black teachers, Hispanic teachers in this district. So I knew I had to devise a method to get them. So I got very conservative board to vote with me in authorizing the superintendent to establish an affirmative action plan for recruiting more minority teachers. One of the reasons the superintendent gave me for not having any more black or brown teachers than we had was because they recruited 75% of their teachers from out here at San Diego State. And I said, well, that's the problem. Because that Department of Education at San Diego State didn't even welcome black and brown candidates to become a part of your department. Okay. I said, what you got to do is to go where there are black and brown candidates, which means for black, you're going to go south.
Exactly. Okay.
And for Hispanics, you're going to go to the southwest. And we started doing that. Our recruiter every spring would go down south, visiting those black colleges. That's how.
So you made a point of targeting the Hispanic black colleges.
Yeah. And Bertha Pendleton, you know Bertha.
I do. I want to interview her.
She was in college with me at Knoxville College, and I knew her, a very bright girl. She's 2 years behind me. But she was working for the Tennessee Valley Authority, but she wanted to come to San Diego and teach. So I had Dr. Croft, who was the personnel director, to set up an appointment to interview her down in Tennessee. So she met him at Peabody College down there. He gave her an application right there. And, you know, she came on to become superintendent of education.
Yes, exactly.
So you have to be aggressive like that. And I stayed there 16 years on the board, and during those 16 years, I served.
So you were on the board, the school board, for 16 years?
16 years.
And you were the first elected black official?
In of anything in San Diego County.
Okay. That's fantastic.
Was president of the board for about four times. Then I went on nationally to be president of what was then called the Council of Great City Schools. It was an organization made up of the 28 largest school districts in the country, whose headquarters was in the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. And as a president, I enjoyed my kingfish status. Because when that limousine would pick me up at Dulles Airport for a meeting to take me to the headquarters at the Watergate, the guy getting me out of the limousine, I'd have to check in at no desk. Took me straight upstairs to my suite. That was good living.
Now this was that you were the
president
of what was the name?
Council of Great City School.
Okay.
And then after that, became president of the National School Board Association, the 94,000 school board members.
What year was that approximately?
That was 1977.
Okay.
And very few black folk were on school boards during those days. But that was a great experience because I got to visit every state in the union. Giving an annual speech at the annual convention. And we were headquartered in Evanston, Illinois, very conservative town. So during my tenure as president, I got that board to move the headquarters from Evanston to where the action was in Washington, D.C. And also during my tenure, we chose a new executive director. But even more important was the fact that whereas those 17 or 20,000 people at our annual convention, that many attend, had not heard any nationally known black speaker or entertainer. I started bringing in.
Oh, okay.
Whitney Young was the first black I brought in.
Mm.
And Alex Haley spoke at the convention where I was leaving the presidency. And I got black entertainers to come. Duke Ellington make some of that money.
Mm.
Paying him $25,000 a concert.
So, oh, wow.
So that was a great experience. And folk began to talk about, you got to go for 20 years. I said, no, I'm tired. I am tired. And at that time, the church was very...
So I was getting ready to say you were still heading, was still Golden Hills?
The session, no, had changed. No, yeah, it was still Golden Hill at that time. But the session had given me an associate minister so that during the week, the membership of the church was covered.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. And yet, being involved in the total life of San Diego, which is the only way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And all the rest is history, et cetera. I had a lot of different experiences with different folk. Much of it you can get, some of it you can get out of the little paperback book
Conscience.
I put together.
When did you publish Conscience of the Community?
In the year 2001.
Okay. And that book is about your life. It's a biography, autobiography.
Autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it.
What is the greatest change that you have experienced in San Diego from 1956 to now? I know there are many, many, many changes. I guess I want to ask, what do you feel as an African American that we have overcome, and what do you feel?
Well, I think the greatest change, social change in San Diego, is the change that has come in housing.
Okay.
Because when I came here, black folks were basically forced to live south of Market Street. Housing segregation was rampant. And you didn't find any black folk living in most of these communities in San Diego County now. So housing is the greatest social gain that has happened since I've been here.
Okay.
And you have seen an increase in the black middle class folks, which mean blacks with more education and better jobs. That has been good.
What about the school system?
I think basically the school district is not as good as it was when I came here.
Okay.
I dare not want to say that I know the reason, and I think you and I both can point to some reasons. All of it isn't just the school district's fault.
That is true.
San Diego, I still say, having been president of the 28 largest school districts in this country, I happen to know that San Diego still has a better urban school district than a lot of those throughout this country. I have always said that in every school in San Diego, whether it be La Jolla or Southeast, there's enough learning going on that no kid should be able to say, I can't.
Right.
It's up to the parent, them, and the teachers to make that into fruition.
I wanted to get back to your book. What inspired you to write the book? And did someone approach you
basically
about...
Basically, my white friends here in San Diego. Not black friends, white.
Okay.
They said to me, George, before you develop... That was when I retired December 31st, 2000. Mm-hmm. They had said prior to that time, George, you need to put down some of your memoir before you develop Alzheimer's.
Okay.
They said, listen.
Now this is retiring from the church.
There's nobody in San Diego who knows as much about San Diego as you do, because we tell you things we don't tell each other.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was my good white friends that kept prevailing mm-hmm. upon me to do that.
Okay.
Your folks never asked anybody. I'm sorry, but it's the truth.
I know what you're saying. I do indeed.
So, for the benefit of all, and I have just hoped that I could get black kids to read about how San Diego was and some of the players mm-hmm. that I used to had respect for and don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't even like to read, you know. We got the television series.
Right. But that was one of the reasons I feel this project is so important, so that our young people can get to see yeah. the contributions that African Americans have made to their community. I don't even think they have a clue how much of a presence it is in the community. So, what would you like to see changed as far as its African American youth in this community? There have been so many news stories about the negatives. Now, I'm in church most Sundays, and there are a lot of positives going on, or at least the students, the young people are there, but you just get to hear about the negative part of the community from when they think about African-American students. Do you feel that there are things that can be done to increase the positive presence?
Well, first of all, I over the years have grown tired of everybody looking to the church to solve all of our problems.
Okay.
I think most churches, if they have any young folks at it, and there are too many of our young folk who do not even don the doors of the church. You can't hold the church responsible for those kids who on Sunday morning should be at church in Sunday school and yet outside roaming the streets.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the great problems in our black community. When I was growing up, and when you were growing up,
mm-hmm.
people went to Sunday school and church in our community, and those kids in those families who didn't go were ostracized.
That's right.
Now
it wasn't even an option in my household.
No option, and now you're ostracized if you go.
That is true.
So that's a major problem, and until we get that mentality turned around, we're going to continue to have the problem that we're having. The teaching of at least they could get the teaching of some kind of values,
mm-hmm.
which they don't seem to have now, which is acted out in the violence, etc. So we can talk about the problem in church all we want to. We can point out the bad. But there is reason for that, and that is the fact that parental influence has not been collectively so positive that it had permeated the minds of our young folklore.
That is true.
It's sad.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, is there anything else you'd like to add? This has been wonderful.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I talk too much as it
is. No, you don't. This is a wealth of information that people need to know, and you've made such a... what is the one thing you've done that makes you the proudest
I think, I think 16 years on the school board,
mm-hmm.
which completely revolutionized the whole thinking of that institution. And the advocacy I did on behalf of youngsters.
Okay. All right, Reverend Smith, thank you so much for your time. It's been great talking to you, and I'm always energized talking to you because I see what a difference one person can make. You have definitely made
One thing I like to say, Gloria, is this, that I think that everybody, I don't care who you are, how learned you are, or how ignorant, you have a story to tell,
mm-hmm.
and you should put it down, no matter how crude and rough or how smooth it is.
That is true.
Everybody has a story to tell.
And someone can get something from that story.
That's right. Because my philosophy is this, that if you cared enough to write it, I should care and respect you enough for you to print it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I attend functions and you speak and you've gotten so many honors and awards, what honor and what award means the most to you and why?
Oh, God.
While you're thinking about that, I've also, you have a couple of favorite jokes that you either begin with or you end with, and I'd like to hear one of those. Do you know the jokes? The one with, after a while, it's just like the parts of the pig, and then the other one the pancakes.
I think that, what are the... the true honors, and I've gotten so many of them. You look at the office now, that just since 2000, all that stuff, which I really said, I wish this was money rather than paper. But I think when Steve Weber gave me that
honorary doctor,
because he let me know that the first one was given to John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one to Shirley Chisholm. And I said, for him to even identify me on the level with those people, it
sets up.
That is
definitely an honor, yeah.
And I guess the second one was the theme that you were at out there at USD.
Leaders in Education. Okay.
I think what the inscription on that thing said was what has been my forte all my life here in San Diego.
Mm-hmm. And I have to read that. I can. What year did you receive? You were the first local person to receive an honorary doctorate from San Diego State.
Is
that correct? Yeah. And what year was it? I can always look at.
Dip in that.
I'll get the date for that.
And copy it down.
But
there.
That definitely is.
Saturday evening, Irene and Carolyn was digging over pictures, and we had came upon such a beautiful portrait of Colin Powell with Irene and me.
Oh, wow.
Down here at Maury Wax's house. I had forgotten all about it.
Oh, wonderful.
So I told Irene.
Can we have that for our collection?
you ask her about it.
I sure will.
The past year, that woman so long, I don't ask her permission for nothing. But I've had a lot of great moments in my life, too. A lot of great moments.
Okay. Fantastic.
I've been the kind of person who doesn't like to get involved in nothing without doing something about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, too many people They want to swim, but they don't want to sink very far.
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah. And back to my story about all that stuff that hangs on the wall.
Uh-huh.
Friend of mine who's from North Carolina.
Okay.
He and I used to sit around in early years. At the time, he was passed up at Long Beach, and I was down here. Soon after I got here, we would be talking, and he said, "Joy, I don't care whether I ever get a doctorate degree. Do you?" I said, "No, it may be nice, but I don't care for what." And so finally, Sterling College out in Sterling, Kansas, gave him an honorary doctorate degree. And I said, "Hey, St. Paul, that's his name. St. Paul Epps is his name."
Mm-hmm.
His son is, he conducted, you probably saw him, some of his work. He conducted at the Old Globe.
Oh, okay. I've heard of it.
Sheldon. Mm-hmm. Sheldon Epps.
Okay.
But anyway, I said, "St. Paul, I thought it didn't matter to you whether you got a doctorate degree or not." I said, "I thought we had agreed that that's the case." He laughed. He said, "Joy, you know, I look upon this doctorate degree just like I look upon the tail of the pig. It may not serve any purpose, but it sure tickles the head." I thought that was
a very good one. Well, thank you. We will end on that note. And thanks for giving us a glimpse of what you have done in the community. And this will be made available for our young people, for our old people, for scholars, for anyone who would like to know about the African-American presence in San Diego.
Well, all I want to say is everything I've said is the truth.
And that's all we care about.
Oh,
I appreciate it.